Well, good afternoon. Good to see all of you. Emil, very nice job. Thank you. I have a question, technical. This shouldn't count against my time, by the way. I heard? I reserved 5 minutes the other gentleman's time. Some of you got it. Yeah, okay. But seriously, I know who Hillsong is. Can you broadcast that? It was very well done. Loved it. Can you broadcast that? Okay, good. Done. No more technical questions. Thank you very much. It is good to see all of you again. Becky and I think it's been 2 or 3 months since we've been up. But I need to tell you, we were so excited, or I was, but we both were. When we came back down to the church in Los Angeles, we told everybody about you. And you got me in a lot of trouble, a tremendous amount of trouble, because in telling them about y'all, I said, this is the way they conduct services up there in Orinda. And they said, what? And I said, well, they have this clock. They said, a clock? And I said, what happened to the 45 minutes? No, I didn't go to Ambassador College. You can put it back down to 45. So I said to them, they've got this clock, and they time the messages. They time the messages? I said, yeah. 45 minutes. What happens after 45 minutes? I said, I don't know. I was under the time. You guys won't be, but that's why we need the clock. They were not happy with me. This went very, very badly. It got worse. I said, and for message chat, they do it right after services. They do? I said, they do. And they have the clock up again. And they get 15 minutes. They said, this isn't what we do down here. I said, I know we don't. So you got me in a lot of trouble, and so they ask me now occasionally, what would they do in Orinda? How would they do it there? So anyway, just wanted to put, I like the clock. I won't need that much time. Remember, I'll remind you again, this is 53 minutes. At the 40, 45-minute mark, my wife either does this or she gets up and leaves. I want to know about this TV thing, Mark Philip. Where is he? What's with the TV in the lab? What were you doing in the lab? I'm serious. What were you? Oh, really? Good for you. Wow, that's interesting. Good. Sorry to ask during the message, but I'm not going to use this time. Interesting. Very good. By the way, I've got a word for you. For syndoce is the root word for self-awareness. Yo, it means woke. You see, everybody under 35 got that. So anyway, no, very nice job. Well, I wanted to bring a little bit of Los Angeles up to y'all. And in Southern California, I've started a series on the book of Daniel. And we've gotten through 4 chapters. And I thought, what could I speak on up in Orinda? And I said, I'll bring Daniel up to them. And so this is the 5th in a series of Daniel. And in fact, it's Daniel chapter 5. Very good. Chapter 5. And so I've changed a little bit. It was a little sad. Because you broadcast just like we do in Southern California, you webcast services. So I did have somebody come up to me today and say, hey, enjoyed the messages on Daniel. And I went, uh-oh. Well, you're going to get it, a little bit of what I got last week. But I've altered it, changed it up, restructured it just for you. This chapter is very interesting, chapter 5 is. It is, in fact, legendary. And it has its effects even to this day into popular culture. Phrases, a very specific couple of phrases from this chapter, have entered multiple, in fact, dozens and dozens of books, plays, artwork, songs, film, poems, philosophy, even to an oratorio by Handel, the composer, and even, believe it or not, a sentence from this chapter made it into a James Bond theme song. I bet you're just dying to know which one it is. Well, you're going to have to wait through the message. But this chapter tells us some fascinating subjects, and it's a complete departure from the prior 4 chapters. It talks about a well-planned feast with an absolutely, positively clueless leader. It uses some interesting as well as some very tragic elements for that feast. And all the while this feast is occurring, an invasion is occurring that will rock Babylon, and a judgment by God. The purpose of the series and this particular message is to apply the concept that I think we would all agree to one extent or another, we do live in a type of Babylon. You know, my wife and I, when we come up to the Bay Area, you guys are so tech savvy up here. I mean, it's not like Southern California is in the Stone Ages. It's not, or the Dark Ages. But you are very tech-oriented here. And the technology in Google and Facebook, both of which are headquartered up here, are in the news every 2 or 3 hours, let alone every day. It's very interesting. And the tech can be, if it overtakes our lives, as long, so many other systems, is a type of Babylon. I love the tech. By the way, I have a smartphone. I have a laptop. My wife and I have tablets. We have computers. We just don't turn them on. No, we turn them on, and we use them. But we live in a different world, and the world is not ours, and we are not of this world. And therefore, God commands us to live appropriately by his commands and to respond appropriately, all the while living in this type of Babylon. The title, if you want one, and I know this group does, you guys like stuff written down. I don't know if it's going to appear up here again. But it's The Last Night in Babylon, with a subtitle, You Knew. So if you all turn, please, to chapter 5 for the fifth test of Daniel. A quick preview, if you're not familiar with the book of Daniel, every chapter is a different test. And the previous four tests, and in fact, if you want a really good, not very long, but a substantial read on the Sabbath, Daniel is a great book. It's a great Sabbath read. Here's the setup. In 586 BC, or approximately thereabouts, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon has sacked, destroyed Jerusalem, and carted off thousands and thousands of captives. Young Daniel and his three friends were among those captives. What was his three friends' names? Ham, Shem, what was the third one? Yeah, I froze you, didn't I? I froze you up there. What are the names? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those are their pagan Babylonian names. Those are the ones you remembered? Yeah, I know. No, you're right. You're good. It's good. It's all good. So Daniel and his three friends, the number one test in chapter 1 is a test of food. Will they eat from the king's table? We're not quite sure what it was exactly that he was eating, but they would not eat from the king's table for whatever reason, and they were blessed, they were strong, they passed the test. In test number 2, King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. He had a dream of an image of gold, silver, bronze, iron, and feet of clay. This image bothered him. The king called the magicians, the necromancers, all their wizards, whoever they had, the soothsayers, and only Daniel was able to interpret the dream of four successive kingdoms. He passed again. Test number 3. If Nebuchadnezzar not learned, it was the image of gold that he had as another dream. And this image of gold caused forced worship. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were all thrown into the fiery furnace, as you remember. They would not bow down to the king, and they were spared. And you remember the image of the Son of Man was in the furnace with them. So he passed again. In each successive case, there is a pattern. And that pattern is Nebuchadnezzar comes closer and closer of being aware of the God of heaven and obeying him. Closer and closer. In the fourth test, Nebuchadnezzar has another dream. And this is of a great tree. And the tree, where it switches in this vision, he becomes an animal. And for 7 years, he gropes around on the ground eating grass. In fact, it has a name medically for it, boanthropy, where people do believe they have become an animal, an ox or a cow. And for 7 years, he ate. But this dream bothered him before he knew what was going to happen. And once again, who but Daniel, among all the wizards, of all the prophets that they had, Nebuchadnezzar asked Daniel, and Daniel knew. And at this point, at the end of chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar begins to praise the God of heaven. And I invite you to read chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar is a pagan king. And we see some slow, very slow, but very perceptible, I'll call it a semi-conversion. And now we come to test 5. It is another unique section in the Bible. In this chapter, Hebrew is no longer written, it is in Aramaic. Daniel has Aramaic in its center, with it begins in Hebrew and ends in Hebrew. But in this section, starting in chapter 2, in fact, and all the way through chapter 5, it is in Aramaic. So let's set the stage. Nebuchadnezzar is gone. He has died. And there is a royal romp, as one commentator makes it, a royal feast of epic proportions. And so begins chapter 5. He introduces drinking vessels, and once again, it turns out to be a very, very bad choice. Once again, remember, King Nebuchadnezzar, the one we think of at Babylon, he is gone, and his son, grandson, Belshazzar, is semi-co-regent of the kingdom. The story begins, verse 1. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of 1,000. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels, which his father, Nebuchadnezzar, had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lord and his wives and his concubines might drink from them. This is a series of very bad decisions, and it's entitled Belshazzar's Feast. Belshazzar wishes to honor his lords. We have no real reason, we have no way of knowing what this was about. But it says there was 1,000. In the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, it says there are 2,000. What's the point? There's a lot of people at this banquet. It is enormous. It's huge. And what are they doing? They are drinking. The word wine is significant. It's used in these short verses 3 to 4 times in its cognates. It all started, this chapter does, with drinking wine. And we all know what happens when you drink too much wine. He then decides to bring out the Jerusalem temple vessels that have been stored somewhere. Now keep in mind, these vessels, these golden vessels from Jerusalem in the temple, have been stored for decades and decades, some almost 50 years. When Nebuchadnezzar conquered and sacked Jerusalem and the temple, these have been hidden away, and they've never been touched, we guess. And apparently, Nebuchadnezzar had never pulled them out. I mean, wow, never touched them. We'd never hear of them until now. Apparently, Nebuchadnezzar kept them where they were, possibly for a very special reason. He was starting to recognize who God was and possibly what he had done in Jerusalem, but that's just speculation. For Belshazzar, possibly Belshazzar among all his lords, and they were all drinking, possibly he was mocking the Jewish captives from the captivity almost 50 years ago. So let's bring out the vessels. Let's bring out the golden vessels that were used in their temple and relive the conquest. Possibly he knowingly violated Nebuchadnezzar's decree, for he had said, Nebuchadnezzar had said, it was illegal to make light of the God of the Jews, not to mock them. We really don't know, but whatever the reason, you'll see that this was a very, very bad decision by Belshazzar. We just don't know, but it was very bad timing. Verse 5, in the same hour, and you'll see this idea of timing, in the same hour that these vessels were taken out and they were drinking the wine, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance changed. Now listen to this description. It's pretty graphic. The king's countenance, his face, changed. His thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, and this is just a repetition of what had happened the last 4 chapters. He calls them, and then he makes a proclamation. Whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple, the royal colors. Clothed with purple, have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler of the kingdom. And once again, this is in the 5th chapter, all the king's horses and all the king's men, all the king's wise men, they came out, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance again was changed, and his lords were absolutely puzzled, confounded, dumbfounded. And it happened immediately. This hand came out. Now, I don't know about you, but if we were having a potluck here and a hand came out and started to write something on the wall, I think your knees would knock too, or at least mine would. Also, the handwriting was opposite the lampstand. Remember, this is a big cavern with thousands of people in it in Babylon. The hand that was writing wanted everyone to see exactly what was happening, so it was like putting it near that very bright light, a lampstand. Everyone could see, and he writes biblical, as it were, graffiti. His knees knock. His face changed repeatedly. He is scared to death. Whose hand is this? What is it all about? I would imagine he's either pretty well to drunk, or he is drunk, which makes it even worse. It was what we call the handwriting on the wall. Today, if I were to say handwriting on the wall, that would be an evil portent. It's something not good. It ain't good. And for Belshazzar, he knew that. Because of the eeriness of the hand, all the more reason he was scared. He also could not read it. Now, there's a difference in all the dreams of knowing something. In other words, there's languages. Many of you I know speak multiple languages. But you may not be able to read it. If you can't read it, you can't interpret it. And there's two issues there. If you can't read the writing, you surely can't interpret it. And that's what Belshazzar wanted. We asked the question, it's interesting, was it written in Aramaic? We just don't know. It would be a language that they would understand. Because these were the wizards, these were the Chaldeans, the soothsayers. These were trained men. They're apparently not very good at interpreting things, because this is the fifth chapter where they've blown it, and they haven't been able to answer it. No one could read it. No one can understand it. And just exactly as in the previous chapters, and you may remember the dreams, they couldn't interpret the dream. They didn't know what the dream was. Nebuchadnezzar would say, tell me what my dream was and tell me what it means. Well, your lordship, O king, live forever. Why don't you just tell us what the dream was and we'll tell you what it means. No. If you're the bright guys I think you are, and I'm paying you a lot, and you've had a job forever, not only tell me what my dream was, what I dreamed, and then tell me what it means. They couldn't do either. So just like Nebuchadnezzar before, he promises riches, nobody could answer, nobody knew. And once again, they blow it. Now, if Daniel 1 began 50 years prior, at least for the book of Daniel, these Chaldeans, these astrologers, they haven't been able to answer anything. Now, let me ask you a question. Fair question. If you have a job and you have a boss, and your boss kept going to you and asking you, hey, help me out with these numbers. Can you explain what these numbers mean? And you look at them and you go, I ain't got a clue. You know, Harry, this is the fourth or fifth time that I've asked you this. Would your boss have you around? But these guys have a job for decade after decade after decade, which proves to you about the government. If someone can't solve issues and you keep them around forever, something's wrong. So we have a dilemma here. We have a dilemma. How are we going to get this answered? Who steps in? The queen. Now, in reading this, I don't want to add to, or detract from God's word. But I always wonder how the words that we read are said. Maybe it's me. This is the queen. We would call her the queen, queen mother. In other words, she was married to a prior king, maybe Nebuchadnezzar, we really don't know. But the queen has been listening to all this. She wasn't invited, but she overheard it. So verse 10, let's read verse 10. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. Now remember, she's not been invited. How would you feel if you were the queen mother, and you hadn't been invited to the ball? You wouldn't be too happy. So she's come to the banquet hall. The queen spoke, saying, I don't know how she said this, but I can guess. Maybe, let's just try this. O King, live forever. O King, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the Spirit of the Holy God, and in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father or grandfather, the king, remember him, made him chief of the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and soothsayers. So he already knows this. Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas. That's an interesting phrase. Explaining enigmas means literally in the Hebrew, untying knots. He can do all these things. These attributes were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. So the queen comes in. She's probably not happy. And as with Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel is sought out. What's interesting, just as a technical point, in verse 11 it says, Spirit of the Holy God. How many of you have another translation in your Bible? It doesn't say Spirit of the Holy God. Is everybody using New King James? Oh, okay. What's interesting is it's probably not the best translation. Because coming off the queen's lips, one would not think that she would say Spirit of the Holy God as a reference. It more than likely is the Spirit of the gods, which is more in context with the rest of what she is saying. So, and at the end of the day, it doesn't matter to the story anyway. In whom is the Spirit of the gods? So he had this ability, and they would even say some divine ability, to untangle these mysteries. Daniel did it without thinking about it. And in the prior four chapters, in fact, he did. What's interesting is also is that Belshazzar is reminded, your father, remember him, or technically his grandfather. Your grandfather named Daniel the chief of the astrologers. In other words, he's not here. He wasn't invited like I wasn't invited. So you might want to call him. He's got a very good track record. In fact, it's 100% as opposed to these guys. And so she brings up the concept of the father. So why didn't Daniel come out with the other magicians? And he was chief. So call Daniel. We pick it up again in verse 13. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel? Notice he doesn't call him Belteshazzar. He calls him by his Hebrew name. Are you that Daniel who was one of the captives from Judah? What a way to begin it, right? Hey, are you one of the slaves of the country that we completely annihilated about 50 years ago? Are you that guy? Are you one of those people? It's a great way to start off a conversation when you need somebody's help. You're one of those captives from Judah whom my father and king brought from Judah. I have heard of you, that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, and they should read this writing and make known to me the interpretation. But as usual, I added that, as usual, they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you that you can give interpretation and explain enigmas, untie knots. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. This is pretty heavy stuff. The reward is great. Just read the writing on the wall and give me the interpretation. I don't know whether Daniel could hear his knees knocking. So the stage is set. I want you to picture this because I think the writer of Daniel wants us to picture this. I want you to picture the throne room. There's a party or a feast that's going on. Thousands of people are there. Daniel by now is well into his 60s, possibly 70s. Now we know, everyone, this is a well-known fact, that men, when they get into their 60s, are indeed extremely wise and knowledgeable. I'll take that as agreement. But Daniel he's tired. He's tired of being brought before and being treated like this, I'm sure, but he's a good soldier. He's been living in Babylon an exemplary life. In fact, I think he became rather attached to Nebuchadnezzar. He could see Nebuchadnezzar change, but all the while living in Babylon, he lived an exemplary life, which is a clue to the chapters of Daniel in this message. He's brought in front of the king, in front of thousands of people who are probably pretty well loaded. They've had quite a bit of wine. He probably can see the golden vessels that are out, and he knew exactly where they were from. He had to. He's looking at the king. The king has brought the vessels out. They've been drinking from them. I can only imagine what Daniel is thinking while he sees this. He is told that his old friends, the magicians, the soothsayers, once again have failed the job, and he's been called in. He is told that they could not interpret, they could not even read, that they were utterly confused by what they saw. He says, "You're the one that can untie knots." He's promised riches. What would he say? Do you feel he was under pressure? I want you to read the way Daniel responds. By the way, when in the prior chapters, when Daniel would go before Nebuchadnezzar, just as the queen did, the typical phrase was, "Hail King," or "O King, may you live forever." Watch Daniel's response. Verse 17. Daniel answered and said before the king, "Keep your gifts. Let your gifts be for yourself, and give your reward to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation." Daniel is extremely serious. He doesn't say, "O king, live forever," because he knows he won't, as we'll read. "Let your gifts be for yourself, but I'll read and interpret it. I'll make known the interpretation." Verse 18, "O king, the Most High God gave your father, Nebuchadnezzar, a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. And because of the majesty he, God, the Father, Most High God, gave him, Nebuchadnezzar, because of what God gave to your grandfather, the king, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when," verse 20, "but when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed, taken down from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts. His dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven. Till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints it over to whomever he chooses." "Keep your stuff, Nebuchadnezzar. I'll interpret the writing. I'll interpret what the words mean." He recounts the history of Nebuchadnezzar, and once again, just as the queen did, Nebuchadnezzar's name is thrown up in Belshazzar's face. "Let me remind you what your father or grandfather did. Let me remind you." Nobody likes that. I mean, I got to tell you, nobody likes saying what your father told you. Reminded, your father told you this. It says that he became like a wild cow or ox. It is called boanthropy for 7 years. And then, in the acknowledgement that God, I think Daniel knew that he liked the king. And the king changed his life. To what degree, we don't know. And I invite you to read the chapter, the prior chapter. So he acknowledged that the God that Daniel worships is the true king. He sets men up. He takes them down. And Nebuchadnezzar, the great king of Babylon, found this out as well. So Daniel has not started off well, but Daniel is not done, because it's going to get a lot, lot worse. Verse 22, "But you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart." And here's the phrase. It, the whole chapter pivots on. Although you knew all this, you knew all this. We're reminding you, but you remember your father, grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar. You knew this. There can be no more condemning words than you knew this, and you did it anyway. Even though you had this knowledge, you did it anyway. You were aware of your father or grandfather and his story, how he had humbled himself. You knew what happened during the 7 years. You knew he recognized this God as of the Hebrew captives. You knew all this. You knew Daniel had been made chief magician. You knew that. And you knew these vessels were from these captives, and you have toasted pagan gods with them. You knew that, and you did it anyway. Once again, Nebuchadnezzar and or the word father is mentioned 9 times in these short verses. And he knew that. The queen and Daniel drove the point home. You knew all these things. Verse 23. And you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house, God's house, before you. And you and your lords, your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them. I can almost, and I don't want to add to this, brethren, at all, but this is a story where we're trying to paint a picture. I'm sure Daniel didn't stand there with his arms flat against his sides. No speaker does. Nobody that's been up here has not moved their hands. This is the way we talk and we express ourselves. So Daniel, is he pointing at the magicians? They couldn't help you. The vessels that they're drinking from, he may have pointed at them, filled with the wine that had been toasted to the pagan gods. I can see him doing that easily. Your wives, your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, and iron. Remember the image and the wood and stone. Remember the four kingdoms? They're mentioned right there. These wood and stone images, they do not see, nor do they hear, or do they know. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this is the writing. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Two, tekel, you have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler of the kingdom. You used the goblets, the vessels of the temple, Daniel tells him. You toasted the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, which is exactly the prophecy, the prior prophecy of the four kingdoms. More gods of wood and stone, they're deaf and dumb. This is who you drank from these vessels with. This is who you praised, these pagan gods. You knew where they had been taken from my people and God's temple. So the captive, Daniel, living in Babylon, tells the king of Babylon, you have dishonored the God of heaven and earth. So the captive did that. He says in verse 23, the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Let me translate it. Your goose is cooked. 20th century parlance. The kingdom is toast. It will be given to others. You're done. The next kingdom is next up. The silver kingdom, a prophecy from Daniel 2. Verse 30, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, that very night, this all happened, brethren, in just a few hours. This whole chapter, it didn't extend over days and weeks and months. It was hours that this happened. That very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. In hours, Daniel has the purple robes put on him, the chain around his neck, which he said, you can keep it, I don't want it. Daniel said, this ought to last for about an hour and a half. me as the third ruler, he knew it wouldn't last. And while Belshazzar was feasting and toasting to the pagan gods, while that was occurring during this feast with the temple vessels, the Medes and Persians had entered the impregnable walls of Babylon while they were feasting. Gleason Archer quotes the historian Herodotus, and for this poor lady, I'm going to try and read this as slowly as possible. He says, "Hereupon the Persians, who had been left for the purpose at Babylon by the riverside, entered the stream, which had now sunk so as to reach about midway up a man's thigh, and thus they came into the town. Had the Babylonians been apprised of what Cyrus was doing, or had noticed the danger, they would never allow them to enter the city." The quote goes on. Let me summarize it. They couldn't get through the 9, 10, 12-foot walls of Babylon. They were impregnable. But like all cities, they have rivers for a water source. So the Medes and Persians blocked the rivers, dried up the rivers or down to a level that they could march through this into the city through the river, and thus taking over Babylon in one night. They caught them completely unaware. The co-ruler with Belshazzar was known as Nabonidus, and there is a journal called the Nabonidus Chronicle. I'm going to read one, for this poor lady, one line. It says, "On the 16th day of Tishri, Ugbaru, the governor of Gutium, and the army of Cyrus entered Babylon without a battle. This passage indicates that the city of Babylon was taken by stratagem rather than frontal assault." In other words, they dried up the rivers and walked in and destroyed Babylon. Let me ask you a question. On the 16th day of Tishri, what is significant about the 15th and 16th day of Tishri? Anybody know? It's okay, audience participation. Tim's not here. No, seriously. What's the 15th of Tishri? It's the beginning of the Feast of Tabernacles. Isn't that interesting? So where was Daniel? He was in Oceanside celebrating the feast. I'm kidding. But Daniel knew what time of year it was. And so the chapter ends. Daniel, as we've said, is no longer a young man. We have no idea how old he was, but he was probably in his 60s, 70s, or older. He had lived in Babylon far, far longer than he ever lived in Jerusalem. Jerusalem was a distant memory. That's why you hear the songs that you do. Let me not forget. Let me not forget by the water while I'm by the waters of Babylon. Let me not forget Jerusalem. But he had been there much, much longer. The commentators have a consensus that Daniel never left Babylon. Later, when the decree to return to Jerusalem, back to Israel, Daniel was probably too old because the decree was much, much later. He was just too old, and he's also not listed in the returning captives. So more than likely, Daniel died in Babylon. But this chapter is a good and positive chapter for us. It's meant not so much as a history lesson. As colorful as it may be, it's meant to tell us more. For Babylon, it was their very last night. It was all over after this. The kingdom changed. It says, "You knew, Belshazzar, you knew. You'd been given years to know. Your father had taught you, your grandfather, to know and to understand. But you didn't learn. You didn't understand." But it was more. It was the arrogance, the profound and utter arrogance of using the vessels he did, which probably made it all the worse. When he did see, Daniel interpreted the handwriting on the wall. It was far too late, way far too late. And therefore, I think it can give us some lessons, some major lessons. And I've counted 16, and I plan to go through all of them. I'm kidding. There are two major lessons, I think, with some subsets, and you may even be thinking of your own, while we live in Babylon. More than likely, none of us in this room will ever be asked to translate a dream or a vision or the handwriting on the wall for a king. More than likely. I pray you aren't put in that position. But if you are, hopefully you will live as Daniel did. But let me ask you a question, simple question, because the word knew is used repeatedly here and what Belshazzar knew. In fact, all the lords, all the people at the feast, what they knew about what they'd been seen, what they had been shown, and what they were aware of. What have we been shown? What have we seen? What have we been taught? Whether you're 5 years old or 105 years old, your life is a series of learning events, of teaching events. The catchphrase today is a teaching moment. Every Sabbath is a teaching moment. But those of us that have been given the wonderful truths of God that we heard in the first message, these doctrines, these understandings, are meant to help us, to teach us. It's important that the laws and the doctrines that we have, the teachings that we have, the guidance that we've been given, are technically practical application and guidance from God's law. It just doesn't mean thou shalt not kill, thou shalt keep the Sabbath. It's much, much more than that. You shall have no other gods before me. Much, much more than that. And through our lives and through all these years, it's an expression of those understandings. That is what we know. Therefore, what we knew. What we know. It explains in many ways why God and Jesus Christ do give us these applications, just like a parent would, of the great love that they have for us. When you don't love or care for someone, you keep them in the dark. You keep them clueless. You really don't care. But God indeed does care. So the question number one is, what is what you have known, what you have seen, what you understand, and what you and I do with that knowledge that we've been given that is so very, very precious? The second could be, what is the writing on the wall? It's a phrase we use now. It's in our songs. In fact, Becky and I were listening on the drive up. We listened to some music. We listened to some Bible study. And one of the songs at random had that phrase in it. We both looked at each other. Oh, writing on the wall. No, it wasn't the James Bond theme. It was another song. It's a very common expression. Maybe we haven't, I hope, not been given Belshazzar's writing on the wall. But maybe God has given us a few letters. Maybe part of a word that we're supposed to understand what he's trying to tell us. He's trying to tell us. He's trying to remind us. And again, through that love and mercy that he has, that we have been shown and we have known. So maybe he's given us a warning. Maybe he's given you a warning. Maybe he's given me a warning. And that the warning he's given you is utterly different than the person sitting next to you. God talks to each and every one of us, I think, a little differently, because we're very, very different. We all come from different places. We surely don't look alike. I'm always fascinated every once in a while, and those of us that have the wonderful opportunity to speak before God's people, whenever I look out and I think, these people are so different. They don't look alike, especially from the neck up. But they don't look alike from the neck down either. You surely all didn't get you, the guys sure, none of us have the, I'm checking around here. No, we don't have, and none of us have the same tie on. And thank goodness, ladies, none of you are wearing the same dress, right? It's a big deal with women, guys. I'll explain to you later. We're all very different. And I think God speaks to us because of our backgrounds, our cultures, our languages, our understanding, our education, our life experiences, the way we were raised. I think he talks to each and every one of us. And all your life, you're going to be shown what to do and what will also you be taught. What not to do. All our lives, we've been given warning after warning. With most of us, I can tell you in my case, who was the big giver of warnings? Mom. Mom's usually the big giver of warnings. The worst phrase that I could hear, and I don't want to put anybody into child Freudian depression here, but the worst phrase I heard when I was a kid, of bad things to come, very bad things to come, you knew better. Some of the people have started crying. Can we get somebody over to these people? Right? I saw some heads move. You knew better. I knew when I heard that from my mother, I was in unbelievable trouble because I did know better. I did know better, and I did it anyway. You knew, we know what is right and what is not right or wrong. We therefore have increasingly less and less excuse to do these things over and over and over again. We therefore watch Belshazzar and what he knew, the way he lived, and what he did not do, what he failed to do. He did not repent. He did not humble himself and guard against those things that were going to eventually take his life and thousands of people with him. Even Nebuchadnezzar, and I invite you to read the preceding chapters, it'll take you less than a half hour. Even Nebuchadnezzar realized that God controls our breath in his hand. Verse 23. And we know this. There's a side subset of issues here. Is that it's been said, wheels of justice move slowly. We get very impatient when things don't happen the way we think they should. The wheels of justice move slowly, but they grind sure. And they grind fine. So this chapter also tells us that prophecies happen. God prophesied there would be a gold kingdom, the Babylonian, followed by the silver, the Medo-Persian. And in fact, that is exactly what happens. This is the fulfillment of prophecy. God's judgments are sure. None of us are immune from it, even when we live in Babylon. So in the end, we are also reminded, be careful. Be very, very careful what cups you drink from. It might belong to someone else for another purpose.